there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Stadio podcast. I'm Ryan Hun. No Musa today, unfortunately. Musa wasn't around and we couldn't kind of find the time that we were both around to record. So I'm going to be joined by a guest today, and that is no other than Ken Early from Second Captains, one of mine and Musa's favourite football podcasts, podcasts we've been on before. We love the Second Captains guys. So it was really, really great that Ken was around to come and help out. We will talk about the Premier League stuff from this week, and we'll also talk a little bit about Xavi announcing that he's going to stay at Barcelona until the end of next season, fulfilling his contract after originally saying that he was going to leave. We didn't manage to talk about Inter's Scudetto win. However, Moose and I will talk about that at a later date. But before we get into that, first of all, hope everyone's staying safe, staying well. I've got a quick bit of admin. There's a Righty's House live show in London on Thursday, the 2nd of May at King's Place. And if you want to join Ian, Flo, Moose and myself, go to the Righty's House Twitter account. The ticket link is in the pinned tweet if you want to go and buy tickets. We'll also pop a link in the description if you want to just click to buy tickets. So hopefully we'll see you there on Righty's House. Flo and I will be joining Ian on Friday, and there'll also be another Righty's House on Sunday after the North London Derby, and then Moose and I will be back on Monday. So that's all the admin for now. But let's get into today's show. And as I mentioned, stepping in for Moose today, I'm delighted to welcome to the Stadio podcast from Second Captains, Ken Early. How are you, Ken?
Very well. Ryan, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, man. Thanks very much for joining me today to just to chat a little bit about football from this week. I suppose the first place to begin is Goodison Park. Everton's first win over Liverpool in the derby at Goodison for 14 years since Mikel Arteta was still there. Beating Liverpool 2-0. Yeah. Keen to hear your thoughts on this because, I mean, it was probably, from a performance point of view, probably the performance a little bit more alarming, you'd say? Or is the result more alarming, or are both equally alarming at this point of the season?
Well, the result kills Liverpool's season. The problem that they have is if it was just one team they were competing against, there might be a chance that that team could blow up.
Yeah.
I don't see both of the teams that they're competing against blowing up. You know, Man City are I think it was at one point behind with two games in hand.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I mean, they've got room for a mistake, and they're still going to finish ahead of, they've got room to lose one out of the last five matches and still finish ahead of Liverpool, even if Liverpool win all their four matches remaining, which at the moment looks really unlikely. The performance in keeping, I think, with a lot of what they've been doing for the last few weeks. And, you know, maybe even a bit longer than that, you know, in the sense of one of the big things about them this season has been, they always, you know, they've won more points from losing positions. They keep getting into losing positions.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily, it's good to be able to show that you're a side that can respond to adversity and can turn a game around and so on, but you can't do that all the time. You know, it's, you shouldn't be in a position where you're having to, you know, do that. And it has been the case, I think, for Liverpool for a lot of the season, starting slowly, not really getting into a game. And then when they do get into the game, missing their chances, you know, which again happened to them, last night, you know, after they'd conceded the first goal, they did get a kind of a foothold in it. There were chances for Nunez, Diaz, and Salah. Was that in the first half?
Still had 23 shots in total, right? So it's like, it's not like they're not creating enough. But I think, like, I mean, you guys talk about, well, I suppose you specific. Well, no, I say you guys talk about Darwin Nunez a lot. And I know he's a player who kind of, he's like the Kai Havertz of Liverpool in the sense of the discourse, right? But like, do you think that basically it was poor finishing from just that front three in is kind of one of the reasons that they're maybe getting themselves into this position. Because I think it's quite interesting when people talk about Liverpool or talk about Liverpool's poor finishing, and that as if it's like something new. But it goes back, like, even when they were just pushing City all the way every year, which I still think, you know, they're pushing City again this year. But like when they won the Champions League and when they then went and won the league, there was all the talk about like, oh, is it actually Sadio Mane? Could he be better at finishing? It's all, I think, because they create such a high volume of opportunity, right? And they kind of overwhelm teams. They're going to miss a load of chances anyway. And Darwin Nunez is just like the latest in the factor of that. Not actually, I don't want to make this about Darwin Nunez, but do you think it's a finishing issue for Liverpool? Or do you think that it's just basically like an accumulation of, I mean, they've had a ton of injuries this season. They've had a ton of turnover in like a load of different positions. There was, you know, Van Dijk again was going through one of those runs where he just kept having like a different centre-back partner almost every week for a little bit. And he was the most senior in that back four.
Yeah.
Do you think it's just one of those where it's kind of amazing that there are even like four games left being like, our league title challenge maybe is over now as it should have been over ages ago if you look at the kind of stuff that we've had to deal with? Or am I being too generous?
No, I think, I mean, if you are to sort of step back and look at the whole season, they've had actually a great season.
Yeah, I think so too.
They obviously won the Carabao Cup. And they won the Carabao Cup in a great way. I was at the final of that, and you know, to beat Chelsea with the injuries they had and the young players that were involved was a great story and a great achievement. They're going to finish third in the league probably, which is a lot better than I was expecting them to do at the start of the season. Because remember, the team was dead. Like it was completely marbled last season. And they kind of were restructuring it. But that process itself in the summer was a bit chaotic. They kind of missed out on their top targets. And it looked as though they were kind of set for a kind of a spell in the fifth to eighth bracket. And instead they've been, you know, chasing for the title until they've sort of collapsed in the last few weeks. So from that point of view, it's been a really good season. But obviously when you've got the chance to actually compete for the title and then you know, the only thing it turns out you can shoot is like your own feet. That is disappointing. And I know you said you didn't want to make it about Darwin, but I think Darwin really has been the biggest disaster of the Klopp era. You know, I think that the signing of Darwin has been the biggest mistake he's made, and maybe the reason why ultimately he felt, oh, I just can't, I can't do it. I can't do this anymore. He pushed the boat out to get Darwin. You know, he was like, this is the guy, bring this, you know, get me this guy. He is, he's going to be the next phenomenon. He's not, you know, he's just a very impressive young athlete who can run around and he's strong and he can compete for the ball and all this kind of thing. He's not a top level striker. You know, he just doesn't have the, you know, when you were talking about, there's always been this element to the Klopp Liverpool team of, the main thing is to create the chances and eventually we'll knock them in. You don't necessarily have to be super clinical. But if you look at that front three that they had, I don't know, Sadio Mane was not necessarily the, you know, the most reliable finisher. He averaged 20 goals a season every season while he was at Liverpool. Yeah. Then you got Salah averaging 30 goals a season while he's been at Liverpool. And you had Firmino who was getting about 15 goals. So reliably, these guys were producing 60, 65 goals per season. Like, okay, that is obviously a very high level performance. It's difficult to replace. But when I look at like the qualities that they brought, the thing about Sadio Mane is that he could kind of do anything. You know, sometimes he would miss a simple chance, but he was capable of scoring the most extraordinary goals. He did have an extraordinary level of technique. I think of the goal that he scored against Bayern Munich, the first of the two goals at the Allianz Arena, the season they won the Champions League. He was a player who was never intimidated. He was a fiercely competitive player. He was physically really strong. He could score all types of goals. You know, I look at Luis Diaz, and I think he's actually a really good player, but he's not as much of an all-rounder as Mane. But the real difference is Firmino. The calmness that he had and the technique that he had. Firmino never scored as many goals as the others, but he, the decisions that he would make, is the way that he played the game in a kind of a sort of a technical trance. You know what I mean? If I look at Nunez running through onto that chance against Everton last night, or the chance that he had against Bournemouth in a recent game, or rather, was it Palace? It was Crystal Palace when they lost to to Palace at Anfield, or against Manchester United in the Premier League game, where he arrived at the back post. He's just flustered all the time. It's like, I'm going to screw my eyes shut and just hit this ball as hard as I can, is his approach to every chance. And that's not what a top striker does. And I feel like they lost qualities with those players who left that they haven't been able to replace.
I mean, I think the interesting thing about Firmino is that Firmino just kind of added that level of connective glue and a little bit of calm. You kind of need one of those elements at the front, I think, just to be the little bit more of a steady agent, I think, which Liverpool don't feel like they have so much this season.
Yeah, we've been since Ajota is injured all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they have been unlucky, but bad luck is always going to be part of it. It's not as though they're short of options. I mean, if you know, probably they played their best football this season when their injuries were at their worst, in a kind of irony, you know, in sense of, I think of January, February, March, they that was probably when they were at their best this season. And they were missing key players in a lot of those matches, and still the guys who came in had come up to standard, and you kind of looked like, wow, what's happening here is really impressive, but it's kind of regressed to the mean a little bit. It's still a better performance this season than I would have expected at the start, but you know, it's maybe Klopp's, you know, most generous act, you know, in sort of sacrificing his own reputation, blowing up the season in the last few weeks, just so that everybody's ready to move on to Arne Slot.
Let's talk about Everton. Sean Dyche rocking up in a tracksuit. Like me, Ken, do you look into the importance of that, or do you think it's a load of bollocks and not a psychological move whatsoever?
Well, it isn't. I mean, it is important.
It is, isn't it?
Dyche actually spoke about this. They lost 6-0 to Chelsea. He said something's going to have to change. He changed his outfit. They beat Forest 2-0. He kept the new outfit. They beat Liverpool 2-0. I think he's going to stick to
2-0 tracksuit. Is that what it's going to be?
Yeah. I mean, is it important? Like, it obviously is, you know? I mean, managers' appearances are really important.
Pep started wearing suits in the Champions League again, and they won it.
Maybe they shouldn't be, but they are. You know, I mean, the reaction to Arne Slot has been completely based on his boldness.
I heard you guys talking about that. Yeah,
it's true. I mean, this is the most important thing as far as a lot. Not everybody. I'm not sure if Michael Edwards has got a, you know, graph somewhere which like plots baldness against points. You know, I mean, Guardiola obviously is there, but like there's different kinds of baldness.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, I mean, Sean Dyche is voluntarily bald, so another level of like
a little bit column A, a little bit column B,
just menace, yeah. There, you know, tracksuit, voluntarily bald, that's a whole level of you know, it's like when Pepe all of a sudden grew his hair out and everyone was just like, oh shit, okay, like we didn't know that.
And he's flanked there by Steve Stone and Ian Wone as well, you know. I mean, these guys aren't messing around. Like,
they're not at all, and they weren't messing around last night, because I actually thought that they opened the game with a real like intensity, which you can kind of see why, even though I think their form has been a little bit all over the place, and I think their season can be quite hard to truly analyze because of all the stuff that's been going on with the points situation.
Yeah.
They are a better team than their league position suggests, I think. And if you add the points on, they will obviously be further up the league. But I think that's kind of, I think some of the games you look back at Everton this season, you see how, I know it's a derby and it's really easy to get up for and stuff, but you kind of see a little bit like, oh man, you could have killed a few more teams off like early if you'd kind of come out like that. And I think their first goal was, I don't know how to explain it, but it just felt like such a Wednesday night derby goal for a team that's struggling against a team that's like trying to still win the league. It was just a bit like, this is going in somehow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You just can't clear it.
It's like gravity. Some kind of gravity is drawing that ball in. It doesn't really matter. I mean, Everton have got the England goalkeeper. Mm-hmm. I know not everyone agrees that he's necessarily a great goalkeeper, but he is the England's international goalkeeper. They have in front of him James Tarkowski, who's one of the most aerial, early dominant centre halves in the Premier League and has been for years, and Jarrod Branthwaite, who looks like an absolutely phenomenal young central defender. Like, that is a really powerful, just basic defensive unit that they're beginning with. I don't really think they've got much going on in midfield. And up front, Dominic Calvert-Lewin has been having like an all-time terrible season. And if you look at, you know, Understat, one of these websites that looks at, like, you know, expected goals and so on and so forth. According to however they calculate expected goals, which is always a little bit vague, but according to their metric, the second worst team in the league at converting chances are Bournemouth, right, who should have scored 8.7 more goals than they have actually scored. Expect, you know, so they've got 49 goals off 57.7 expected goals. The worst are Everton, who have scored 36 goals from 55.8 expected goals. So that's nearly 20 more goals. They've created the chances to score 20 more goals than they in fact have scored, which is just, it's such an outlier. I mean, you're looking at it going, this, there's got to be some kind of bullshit going on here. How can that possibly be the case? But that is what they're saying, which does suggest that Everton's problems have a kind of a, you know, I think that's the area. If Everton are looking to strengthen, and no doubt they will, their financial situation, as we know, is a little bit strange, a little bit strained. But they are going to be looking for someone who can score some of these chances they're making based on, you know, the sort of expected goals stuff. They should be, you know, where West Ham or Chelsea are, instead of being 14th. I know that there's points deductions in place. They should be ahead of West Ham and Chelsea because, you know, points deductions and so on have come into play. But so they are a better side. I mean, I think of their game against Manchester United at Goodison earlier this season. They lost 3-0. It sounds like they got thrashed. They were completely dominant. The first half, they had so many chances, missed so many chances. It was incredible. It was like the ante of the opposite of the game last night, you know, where the first goal you mentioned, where you're just thinking this is going in in the Manchester United game. It was like, how has this not gone in?
It was the Garnacho wonder overhead kick thing, right?
Yeah. I think that was the same game, and didn't Rashford score?
Yeah.
Maybe there was a penalty. I can't remember exactly, but United won 3-0, and it was, you know, they didn't deserve that result, Everton. Last night was a rare occasion where they outperformed the XG and got the job done. But, like, you know, as Klopp said, we let the game be the game Everton wanted.
Yeah.
You know, like a game about sort of set pieces, blocking, you know, aerial challenges in the box. And, you know, they're good at doing that. And this time it came off.
Yeah, I mean, we saw with the second goal, right? For example, I think it's just Trent Alexander-Arnold just stood there kind of looking at Dominic Calvert-Lewin. And you kind of think, like, why is Alexander-Arnold marking Dominic Calvert-Lewin? Why is someone who has a bit more aerial threat, why are they not doing that?
Because Tarkowski was busily making sure that Virgil van Dijk could get nowhere near the ball.
Yeah.
You know,
he had a cheeky nudge on van Dijk as well in the first half. He was getting a little bit.
This is the way it is. You know, there's no point. Van Dijk turned around and screamed at, I think, the referee after that goal. But there's no point in complaining about these types of things. This is just the way it is now.
Mm.
At corners, at set pieces especially, I think they've sort of taken the approach. I mean, I know there are obviously exceptions. I mean, I can think of the Hoyland penalty, the Hoyland-Rodri penalty at Old Trafford earlier this season. Manchester United themselves got a penalty a little bit like it last night when Harry Maguire was sort of pulled down at a set piece. But generally speaking, because VAR can see everything that's happening in the box and there are all these fouls going on, they've sort of decided we're just going to turn a blind eye to stuff that happens at set pieces, because otherwise we're going to have to give penalties the whole time.
Yeah.
That seems to have been a kind of development. Like if you remember the 2018 World Cup when they brought it in, there was loads of penalties for this type of stuff. Yeah. And I think they've kind of gone, this is stupid, we can't keep doing it.
Can't book everyone.
So, yeah, and it's like blocking is like an accepted thing now. It used to be the case that, well, hang on, you can't really do this. But like off the ball blocks, American football style moves are like now what these set piece coaches are encouraging everyone to do. I mean, nobody is doing it better than the team that's currently leading the league.
Mm.
You know, and this is like, this is the way the game is, and you can either cry about it, in which case everyone will laugh at you, or you can figure out how to do it yourself.
I mean, speaking of, before we move on from Everton, I think it's just it's worth kind of just praising them again, because it's a huge, huge win for them. They open up, what now, it's like an 8-point gap on Luton. Everyone's played the same amount of games. in that part of the table from Wolves down. Host Brentford next. They're as good as safe anyway.
Well, it's hard to see Luton getting, you know, 9 points from their remaining four matches. I mean, you know, that's, I can say that's not going to happen. So, you know, here, Luton are playing Everton. I mean, that will, I suppose, be significant. They're playing Wolves, West Ham and Fulham. No, I don't see them winning three out of those games. Yeah. And that's the minimum they've got to do with Everton losing all their games. So, yeah, I think Everton are probably going to be all right.
You mentioned Arsenal briefly, or alluded to them before. Should we just quickly get your thoughts on Arsenal 5, Chelsea 0? I was actually there. And as a fan, it was probably one of the most fun games I've been at for a while, because it was just... The first half was a little bit nervy. I think Arsenal probably should have put a couple more away in that first half. But I don't know, I was talking to a friend about this, about how... Weirdly, and I know this sounds like bizarre that Chelsea, you know, seeing that as Chelsea lost the game 5-0, but I actually thought that in the first half, the way that Pochettino set up against Arsenal was quite smart. Where I was sat, it was Chelsea were attacking like towards the north bank in the first half, and the Arsenal defensive line were kind of hovering about like where we were sat, like in line with us. And you can see that Chelsea just essentially just pinned like four people on that back four and just completely vacated the midfield, like pulled Enzo and Caicedo just away from the middle, and it created this huge space that you could see, you could actually like even hear the Arsenal players like kind of shouting to each other, caused them a bit of bother in terms of them deciding when to press, who to press, and actually like who to pin. And I thought that was quite smart, because every time Chelsea got out, it was basically counterattack, wide, breaking through, using the pace up front, because they had a lot of speed in that front line, and Gallagher kind of making the fourth one being the interlink. And they did have, even though they didn't have a shot on target in that first half, they created a few opportunities that in the ground felt mega nervy, like really, really nervy from an Arsenal point of view, because it was so clear that Arsenal were just way better, but that Chelsea had this I do think it was a plan to kind of sting Arsenal, and they could have very easily, if they'd connected a bit better on a couple of chances that they had, they could have got a couple in that first half.
And then, well, I think you can. Yeah. You wouldn't have been able to see from actually being there the obvious anxiety of Mikel Arteta.
He was on the other side of the pitch. He got booked for something. I couldn't tell what it was though.
I can't remember what it was. The specific.
It
booking,
might have been the Cucurella stuff, because there was a lot of Cucurella stuff going on that side, and I think he got booked for something. And there was the Nicholas Jackson foul as well, which I think should have been a red. Probably.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Well, I've seen reds for that this season.
But yeah, I don't know. Mikel Arteta and Kai Havertz are the two like most nailed on bookings for any Arsenal game. So, I mean, what was the anxiety like from on the TV?
Well, the most striking instance of it was the way that, you know, when Arsenal scored the first goal, which is obviously this huge moment, because it's like, okay, we're actually gonna win this game. Like, I mean, to score early against Chelsea, you see Chelsea and the name is a little bit, oh no, you know, that's a tough game. Then you look at Chelsea, it's Cole Palmer's not there, Malgusto even is not there. This is not the Chelsea that we know and love and remember. But still, you never know with games like this, all the pressure's on Arsenal. They've had the disappointment of the Champions League. Recently, this huge pressure, you know, remember Liverpool haven't lost yet. They're you know, neck and neck. Barring goal difference, City are there. All the pressure is on Arsenal, and you know, are they gonna perform? Or are we gonna see kind of the inhibition that we saw against Bayern? Are we gonna see a failure to put away a team here? And then after a couple of 6 minutes, we're in front, and these are gonna collapse. Right, I mean, they didn't immediately, to be fair, but they resoundingly did by the end. And it finishes 5-0. It should have been 7-0. You know, like Arsenal missed chances towards the end, and I was thinking it would be good for Arsenal to score again here to kind of equalize. You know, from the Wenger's 1,000th game. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like the pendulum has swung fully back now. We've beaten you 6-0. It could have been 6. It could have been 7. That's how, you know, I thought Chelsea were disgraceful.
Really?
I thought they're utter nonsense, especially in the second half. Although a key moment, and I haven't actually seen any Arsenal supporters pointing out the Gabriel Madueke
foul
moment as being, oh, well, you know, justice. It's again the swings and roundabouts. We've been paid back for that Newcastle goal when Gabriel got pushed by Joe Linton. Remember the scandal of St. James's Park. And here Gabriel was flinging Madueke to the ground and then setting off the move that led to the first Havertz goal. So it's good to see that accounts have now been equalised there.
Was that picked up on TV? Because I watched Match of the Day and Jonathan Pearce did the whole Gabriel, he's just too strong there. And just brushed it off, kind of thing.
He just grabs him and throws him on the ground.
I mean it did look like that.
That's rugby.
There felt like a lot of grappling throughout the game. Just off the ball grappling as well, and on the ball grappling.
Yeah, I mean, I think if it had gone the other way for Chelsea 2-1, there would have, you know, some people would have been looking at that thinking, is this not a foul? Mm-hmm. Should this not be brought back? I mean, I don't know if you saw the thing that happened in the Bournemouth Wolves game, but Wolves had a goal disallowed for a foul that happened off the ball before the goal.
Yep.
I mean, crazy stuff. But the anxiety that I was referring to was after Arsenal scored that first goal. Which is a pretty joyful and a moment of joy and relief. Arteta is just arguing with the fourth official. Like, I don't even know what he's complaining about. It just seems so out of place. It's like, you know, come on. This is a good moment, but he was still he was sort of wound up, you know, the way that you were mentioning Chelsea could have scored. I mean, realistically, Nicholas Jackson is not likely to do it, is he? But there were moments where, you know, it's sort of a one-on-one situation in the Arsenal half. You know, Arsenal obviously playing Chelsea's half and Chelsea just kicking it up into space. And yeah, you've seen goals going in like this. And Arteta's just watching with such an expression of, I mean, because this is everything, you know, this is, you know, how sickening it would be to concede a goal to that Chelsea team in those circumstances when you're that dominant. Of course, it didn't happen. Mm. And it's, you know, to sort of restate, like, we're still here, you know, we haven't sort of lost our way. You know, the Bayern thing is a knock on the confidence.
Yeah. And the Villa game as well, I think the Villa game was a big, I mean, I don't know, there's just something about Villa. Moose and I talked about this, that since Emery's gone there, they've just provided, like, in much the same way that Chelsea have probably provided City with more consistent problems this season than any other team. I think Villa have been a real matchup issue for Arsenal. You saw that again. It was excited that they needed to go ahead. You know, even the game last season when they won it at Villa Park, and it was
the Jorginho
off the back of Martinez, and then another one after that was like that sealed it. It was a really awkward game, and Villa have been really awkward for Arsenal, obviously beat them this season. You could see in the difference between the first half in this game and the second half was very much that, like, Arteta had clearly been like seen something that had really wound him up about it, and they fixed it in the second half. And I think Chelsea, even though they did have a couple of chances that Nicholas Jackson went into the side netting, overall it felt a lot more dominant. I just looked at the Gabriel Madueke thing again, by the way, and it's 100% a foul.
Madueke beats him to the ball, and he just says, oh, here. The thing is, Chelsea were so bad that, you know, nobody felt sorry for them. Yeah, it's not like a referee. I mean, the difference obviously between this and the situation at Newcastle is that was a close game, and that goal made the difference to the result, whereas Chelsea were losing this game one way or the other. So they can't come out and complain about it, but it was a like flagrant mistake in Arsenal's favour. So it's not always going against them.
Well, that's it. You know, I mean, I think it would be great to see managers come out and do the same, give like the same treatment, even if they've, because if you think about it, it's a perfect game for that. You can, you know, you could come out and be like, do you know what? It's a fucking disgrace. It's a disgrace that all of these decisions that didn't really matter weren't picked up on in the grand scheme of things. You got to do it for 5-0 when you win, as opposed to just for games that you lose. I think it could be refreshing, Ken. You never know. Instead of releasing statements, but before we move on from Arsenal, how are you feeling, Kai Havertz, at the moment? Because I was listening to an Arsenal podcast called Arsenal Vision, and Tim Stillman made a really good point where he was saying that, like, sometimes when you feel like a team needs something, right, you overlook the qualities of the players who are already there who can kind of do a similar thing. So, for example, if Arsenal had spent 80 million on a striker in January and they'd scored that goal that Kai Havertz scored, or the two goals that Kai Havertz scored against Chelsea, everyone would be like, that's why we paid 80 million for a striker. Whereas actually, it's kind of there. How are you feeling about his kind of role within that Arsenal setup now, before we move on from that game?
Well, I think he's been bad signing. And I think they're kind of, they're getting away with it. Arteta spent a lot of money on Kai Havertz.
Yeah.
I mean, Chelsea replaced him with Nicholas Jackson, I guess. What do they pay? Half the money that they paid for Havertz. Jackson's got, so Havertz so far has got one more goal and one more assist in the league than Nicholas Jackson, who I don't think has been very good for Chelsea. Although there are people who suggest that he's going to, you know, he'll get better and so on and so forth. I'm not sure. For me, Havertz, he strikes me as an in-between player who is not really, he scores goals, but not that many for a forward. He gets involved in the game, but not that much for a midfielder. He's like an in-between.
I think that's exactly what he is.
And I don't think he's a bad player. I don't think he's a bad player. I think he's intelligent. He's got pretty good. He's got pretty good technique. He's useful. And you know, we've seen him. He's obviously scored a winning goal in the Champions League final. I mean, the guy has got some achievements under his belt. I just don't really see why Arsenal decided that they should be the ones to try to solve the mystery of Kai Havertz. Like, what was it? Why does Mikel Arteta have this fatal attraction to, like, I can be the one to unspool the enigma. I can unlock the secret of Havertz. Like, why? Well, just leave it to someone else can do that. You know, have you not got enough to be getting on with? Like, there's someone else with more time on their hands can work on this problem. Now, okay, he's obviously been playing a lot better in the second part of the season than he was in the first. And, you know, he's generally played better when he's up front than he was in midfield. Because in midfield, I don't really feel like he is a midfielder. Maybe he's number 10. I don't think he's a number 8. He wants to arrive onto things and finish things off. I think that's what he's good at, rather than making things happen in the midfield. But like as a striker, I don't know if he's really got the, which was the game? It was a Villa game where he kept getting played in. And Arsenal, it was clever the way Arsenal had done it. He was actually playing in midfield in that game, right? Mm. But they kept sort of spinning this pass over the kind of left side as Arsenal were looking out of the Villa defense, and Havertz was running through from a deep position, and he had some great chances. And he just he's not a top finisher, you know. He's not quick enough. He does have actually. I mean, in fairness, I've seen him have some pretty good finishes, but I've seen him miss plenty of chances as well. I wouldn't consider him to be that. You know, I thought of it. Was it the City Real Madrid game? There was a moment in that when Erling Haaland played. Remember, everyone was panning Haaland after this. Oh, Haaland, you know, he doesn't do anything. He doesn't do anything in the game, but he doesn't score. You know, Haaland actually played Jack Grealish in for a situation in which Grealish should score. You know, if it's Vinicius who's running onto this ball, it's going to be a goal. If it's, the other City players, I mean, half of the other City players are going to finish it. Grealish just couldn't finish the situation because he was not quick enough, you know, in this. For me, I'm looking at Havertz and thinking, yeah, you know, why should Arsenal have, as their centre forward, if that's a position he's going to play, why should they settle for that?
Well, I don't think they will. I think this is the thing about Kai. I think you and I have a bit of a different take on this, and maybe this is because I'm an Arsenal fan. But was a big fan of him from Leverkusen anyway. As an Arsenal fan, quite disappointed he went to Chelsea. But I was just like, that's a really good signing for them. I think he just got moved around under different coaches in different ways. But played an integral role in that Champions League final. But also, I think that he's the kind of player that I feel a lot of modern players fall into, where they're a little bit more role-based as opposed to just position-based. He kind of operates similar parts of the pitch, even if he starts in midfield or if he starts up front. It just depends on the personnel around him. And I think early on in the season, he was delivering a lot of stuff from a defensive point of view. Like, he's really, really important for Arsenal triggering that press at the front. Mm. He's really important for that. And him and Odegaard on the other day kind of essentially played as like a front two when Arsenal were defending. And that's been so key for how Arsenal turn over the ball higher up the pitch this season. But also, I just think the way that he he's not super ball dominant. And I think he complements someone like Rice or Ødegaard, who are a bit more ball dominant, I think. And he's more about finding space and providing option and being kind of support. It's quite like the good bits about Ozil's game when he used to do that. He would always kind of, you'd always see him in space.
Mm.
And I think
he's got a lot more stamina about him than Ozil.
Yeah, for sure. He's like, he's low key really, really quick. He's obviously very physical. He provides a level of safety to Arsenal, I think, that you really notice when he's not there. And I know that a lot of people are just going to talk about goals. They're just going to talk about assists. And they were talking about this early on in the season as well. People, this was the thing that dominated the Kai Havertz thing, was that, you know, when he wasn't scoring, and then they gave him that kind of, you know, that penalty against Bournemouth. And, but I think he's just one of those players who kind of like, how do I say it? I know he came in, you know, a lot of people are looking at him as a direct replacement for Granit Xhaka, which I don't think he is. I think
he's a completely different player.
If you're going like the replacement in quotation marks, I think Declan Rice was the replacement for Granit Xhaka, or the upgrade, if you like. But Granit Xhaka got continually picked at Arsenal under various managers, and all the players loved him. And I think that kind of tells you a little bit more about how valuable they are, because the players can tell, right? The players can kind of tell if someone's half-assing it or not that great. And, you know, you hear, so you see the reactions to them. Like, he never really gets that from anyone. And I remember Jorginho doing an interview with The Athletic and talking about how good Kai Havertz was. And you can actually see that when Jorginho plays for Arsenal, he looks for Havertz all the time. I think the problem that it's created for Arsenal, and the problem that it will create for Arsenal next season if they do get another striker, is how they configure that attack. Because I think in terms of skill set, I think he brings so much to the team in different ways that's not just a goal scoring thing, and it allows, he's quite good at like allowing other people to play around him. He doesn't need to be too, I think that's quite I quite like that trait in an attacking player, is just like they can kind of take charge if they need to, but they don't need to take charge. It's like if other people get involved, they get involved. Yeah. And yeah, I don't know, man. I think he's become actually, I think he's a really, really important part of that team now. Maybe underwhelmed at points. He's far from perfect, I know that. But I think, I'd say actually, I know the fee was quite high and a lot of people were a bit like, ooh. But I'd say in terms of being a part of this next stage of the evolution of Arsenal, I think he's actually been like a really good signing.
I think Rice and the fact that Saliba and Gabriel have basically been fit for the whole season.
They've been a major part of that. Yeah.
These are the big differences for me from last season. I mean, some players like Zinchenko hasn't been as good. Partey, we haven't really seen much of. Ben White's been good. The goalkeeper, I think, is a marginal improvement.
Mm.
You know, I think he has been better.
Mm.
But like, not like, wow, he's so much better. You know, we found our goalkeeper for the next 10 years. You know, I mean, I still wonder what they might do there. But for me, it's like the difference between Arsenal this season and next and last season is like the physical power.
Yeah.
Which has, and if you look at like their team, you know, they've been really consistent with their selections. But look at the ages of the players who are playing all these games. So in the league, Arsenal have got nine players who've played 30 or more matches. Right, but the oldest one of those guys is Trossard. All the others are between 22 and 26.
Yeah.
Right, so this is like a really strong kind of core of players who are at like, not even, who are approaching their peak age, you know, who are able to sort of stand up to this type of demands. I mean, if you look at, if you look at the equivalent list at Man City, you've got like, you've got a few players who are, you know, a good bit older than that. Like, I mean, you've got like, Ederson, obviously 30. Bernardo Silva's nearly 30. Kyle Walker's nearly 34. You know what I mean? Ake, Kovacic, Akanji. These guys are all approaching 30 years old. And De Bruyne would be there if he hadn't been injured for most of the season. He's nearly 33. So it might be one of the reasons why Arsenal still have this energy. You can see that Liverpool have kind of faded.
Mm.
Arsenal's, well, yeah. Although they've leaned really heavily on these core players, they're the kind of players that you can lean on because they're at their absolute physical peak.
I mean, obviously, a lot depends on what happened. We're recording this ahead of Brighton Man City. But I think that game and the North London Derby and the weekend's fixtures, I think, are just huge for the title race. Should we quickly head to Old Trafford and just talk about this another chaotic Manchester United game, 4-2 against Sheffield United? We don't have to spend too long on the rest of these games, but any major takeaways from this, or is it just kind of another game that played out in a way that you'd expect a Manchester United game to play now?
Yeah, they scored the usual four goals.
Bruno's second was very, very good.
He can't stop getting criticized by people. I mean, I see today, you know, there's more just Roy Keane arguing with Ian Wright.
I can't talk about that, obviously.
Yeah, but I do agree more with Wright than Keane here. Like, I mean, what more does this guy have to do, really?
Just needs some help, man.
Well, he is one of the United accounts was tweeting, like, since he arrived in the league, I think the figures were 54 goals and 40 assists. So only Salah has more than that in the Premier League since he signed.
Wow.
Debut. Now, I think maybe I've misremembering the figures, but the claim was, and I haven't even checked the claim, it could be
fake news.
A lie. But he scores a lot and he creates a lot. And okay, yeah. he scores a few penalties. He did again last night. But like, I mean, at some point you've got to go, yeah, you know, that's pretty good. Like, what about the rest of the team here? You know what? But he just seems to get continually attacked in what I consider to be a really stupid way. Like, oh, you know, he's a disgrace, blah, blah, blah. And then obviously you've got all the kind of bad faith people who hate Manchester United, who are, you know, Fernandes is a little cheating rat, you know what I mean? Like, who are always ready to say that about him anyway. I really don't understand what it is. I mean, I suppose the argument that Roy Keane made was, well, he's never won anything. You know, you say he's a winner, but what's he won? Nothing. I mean, I think he's won trophies and...
He won the EFL Cup, he won Carabao Cup, and some stuff in Portugal.
He wouldn't have won the actual Portuguese league because he's playing for Sporting, right?
Yeah, and they only won it for the first time a couple of years ago, after like first time in 20 years or something, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. I think Bruno is one of those players that, you know, you kind of like have this thing in the NBA where people have like a high usage rate, you know, like high, just like very kind of, the ball goes through them, they're on the ball a lot, and you wonder whether they'd be able to do that at a side that was consistently pushing for the title or pushing for Champions League and stuff like that. Then he's kind of done it for Portugal. So
yeah. I would suggest that if Bruno Fernandes, I mean, I know the idea that you're talking about, and the equivalent for Fernandes at, say, Man City would be Kevin De Bruyne. And if Bruno Fernandes was crossing the ball to Erling Haaland, I think he would have a lot more assists and Manchester United would have a lot more wins than they have at the moment. I mean, he's obviously a guy who he tries maybe too much. Maybe in Fernandez's case, this is a criticism that he could make. You know, maybe he needs to be a little bit more selective about when he, you know, people say, oh, he just spams shots and crosses. You know, this is a criticism that's made. But like, I think he's generally doing this stuff at a really high level, at least when you compare it to all the other players in the Premier League. You know what I mean?
I actually think he's the perfect player, not the perfect player, but he's a player who I think in the setup that Manchester United have had over the last few years, that was since he's been there, I think he has, it's kind of highlighted his strengths and maybe some of his flaws at the same time. And I feel that if there is a different structure and a different kind of coaching ethos at the club, when that happens, if that happens, I feel like he is the player who can adapt to that. I think a lot of the Bruno Fernandes stuff at Manchester United is kind of speculating and talking about unknowns because they haven't seen you've seen it with so many Manchester United players. You know that they've got potential, but you kind of don't really know what that potential is because you can't see a clear path to them achieving that necessarily in the current like circumstances there, right? So I think with someone like him, I feel like if you have pieces around him and you have a coaching structure there that maybe kind of just irons out some of the stuff that is a little bit hero bally at sometimes, right?
Yeah, I mean, but I think that's...
What I'm saying is like he kind of needs to be that kind of player, I think, in the Manchester United side at the moment because someone really needs to drive it. Yeah, and I think because of that, you will get this like high volume, you know, high failure rate, but also some goals, assists, and like like the his second goal last night, for example. Like, he will pop up with one of those every now and again, because you kind of need someone to do that at the moment, especially with the kind of state of the club over the last few years. Now, I think as you get deeper into the new part ownership on, and you know, the kind of restructuring of the sporting side, I think he's a really interesting player to see if his role changes or if it develops under whoever that coach may be. Because I'm not entirely sold it's going to be Ten Hag for a huge amount longer.
Oh, I don't think. I mean, I think they'd be crazy to stick with Ten Hag at this point. And I expect that they are going to change, because it's a completely new set of executives who haven't had the chance to appoint a manager. I think Ten Hag's kind of lost a lot of credibility at this point. You know, it would only take a couple of defeats early next season to kind of to finish him, I think. And I think changing this season, bringing in someone more convincing, you know, if you can get someone like Thomas Tuchel, maybe it's a conservative choice, but like, this guy has sort of proven himself at the top level that he can manage really top teams. Like, you know, over the last 5 years or whatever, he's been in the Champions League final, PSG, won it with Chelsea, may get there again with Bayern, even though it hasn't been great at Bayern. But like, you know, he's been, I think he's a more convincing figure to me than Ten Hag. I think the problem, it's partly the problem is Ten Hag, partly it's that I'm sure the new guys coming in would like to appoint someone to take things in their preferred direction. Who that's going to be, we don't know. But I, you know, in terms of Fernandes, I think United are just really lucky to have had him over the last few years. When he arrived, his first season, like, it's 28 goals in 58 games. Now, okay, some penalties and so on. But what do? They bring in Ronaldo. Like, they brought Ronaldo into
that,
the team.
Destabilization, the way that just destabilized everything is,
just nonsense. So, you know, I don't think they are. His numbers kind of collapsed the following season. There was that whole episode with Emi Martinez pointing at Ronaldo saying, you know, why aren't you taking it? The penalty, remember that? You know, it was just weird. Like, I mean, that is not what it's the kind of, it was a typical Ed Woodward era Manchester United mistake. I think he's consistently played well. I think he's been a lightning rod for a lot of the criticism that they've got because they've been weak. And, you know, especially this season, the disappointment of failing to kind of collapsing again after last season. And we also kind of live in an age of, you know, kind of contrarian hot takes. You know, we're actually, it's quite a common one is, you know, that guy you think is the best player in the team? Well, actually, he's the worst player, you know, and it's like, come on.
That literally sounds like a Stadio episode, Ken. I'm not going to lie. That literally sounds like just me and Musa just being like, I don't know, man. I don't know, man.
I think there's one of these, there's a headbanger out there who keeps claiming Odegaard is a problem in the Arsenal team, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there will be.
Odegaard, I'm sick of this Odegaard guy.
Oh, what a fraud. He's a loser. Fraudegaard. That's what it is.
Fraudegaard.
Totally Fraudegaard.
You know, So like, you know, these people are out there. I mean, if there is an opinion that there is somebody out there expressing it, and Fernandes, I suppose, because he's the most eye-catching player in a lot of ways, he attracts that. Well, if he wasn't selfishly using up all this stuff, then we'd actually be better. But I think the reality is that at Manchester United there's barely been a plan. Like, if Bruno Fernandes was not there, like doing what he does, I struggle to see what else would be left.
So after all that, you know, props to Manchester United for winning 4-2. Just very quickly, big up Bournemouth beating Wolves 1-0. Did you catch much of this? Or
no, only the highlights and the usual refereeing scandal.
I mean, does this class it as another one that Wolves have been on the end of?
Oh, I mean, I think so. I thought it was absolutely ridiculous. Mm. But again, it's like this uncanny pattern that you have of, you know, one day one thing happens and then the next day the opposite thing happens. I mean, there was the FA Cup semi-finals. Grealish handles the ball, nothing.
Yeah.
Wan-Bissaka handles the ball, last minute penalty to equalize. Yeah. You know, and then the next round of Premier League games, the Gabriel thing we referred to, and then this nothing incident between Kluivert and Matheus Cunha, which no Bournemouth player appeals for. Nobody has even noticed. The only person who seems to have an issue with it is the VAR, Darren England. And unlike Stuart Atwell, who was too polite to send Anthony Taylor to the screen to check any of his multiple wrong decisions in the Forest game, is like, oh, you know, you need to have a look. You know, I'm not sure about this. You need to have a look at this. And it's just ridiculous. Like, utter nonsense. I mean, it should be a goal. Wolves had a few. I mean, the first day of the season, I remember their penalty they didn't get given at Old Trafford. And Gary O'Neill's head has exploded like multiple times already this season. Mm. Such that last night he was just saying, yeah, you know, I just hope Stuart Atwell's okay. He's had a tough time. Which was, I don't know if it was purely sarcastic or, I mean, you know, he didn't want to get fined again. Or I'm not sure if he has been fined, but I know he's definitely complained. So it's hard to remember every wrong decision, but like, yeah, that was definitely one of them.
One more potentially questionable decision. While we're on that topic, in the Crystal Palace Newcastle game, penalty on Sean Longstaff.
I'm watching it here. I mean, for me, that's a dive.
Oh, okay.
Jesus, covered across him. He knocks.
I mean, do you not think it's one of those where he's been put off balance and then?
I mean, it depends. I mean, I've seen a penalty given for a similar arm across the torso. Sometimes you see these random penalties given, but I mean, for me, it's like, he's come across, he's put his arm, I don't think he's really pulled him down. Maybe, I'm only seeing it from an angle here, maybe he's grabbed a hold of his wrist here and he's actually pulled him off balance, but it looks to me as though Longstaff has just gone, I think I'll try and get a penalty here. So, yeah, for me a rare success.
rare two goals for Mateta in this game, another brace, and Ollie Glasner's Palace are starting to shape up a little bit.
You think they're the new Leverkusen?
No. No, they may be, you know, like they got potential. They got Glasner's Wolfsburg vibes, potentially.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, they've got some really good players.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're going to have them for much longer.
Mm.
Like, I don't see. I mean, do you see Eze and Elise still being there next season? I'm not sure. I don't think so.
I'm not sure.
I think someone will definitely buy Elisa. I think there's a good chance he might go to Manchester United. Because, I mean, if you look at the two of them, Elisa is the more impressive.
Mm.
You know, Eze obviously scored a brilliant goal the other day, is a really talented player. Elisa is, numbers-wise, more productive, is 3 years younger. I think he's got real quality, at least. Like, particularly the thing that sets him apart is the ball striking.
Mm.
Just phenomenal. Like, you know, who gets it? I mean, it's obviously not everything, but it is a big part of the game. I mean, the guy can score free kicks. He can deliver crosses. He can hit any type of a ball.
Mm.
And is able to score. And the problem he's had this season has been he got a big injury in January and missed like loads of games. He's only played about 10 matches, or he's played 10 matches worth of time. But in the, you know, as he's played about twice as much time in the field, and they've both got the same sort of goal involvements, you know, again, I'm just breaking everything down into numbers. But if you're looking at
numbers, guy, Ken,
if you're looking at spending a lot of money and you've got two guys, one of whom is 3 years younger and is producing twice as many goals and assists, then he's probably going to be the guy who...
There was all the talk about him going to City, right? And I think that's what I'm just saying. I'm not into... Unless City shift quite a few players. I think a lot depends on that Cancelo to Barcelona signing as well, because I think that's one that City really, really want to make happen. And I think it's one that Laporta wants to make happen, but I'm not entirely sure a lot of Barcelona fans want that to happen as much, especially because they've got Balde coming through who's been injured, but a lot of the youngsters have been we said this, I think, on the last episode, but that the youngsters have been the ones that have really kind of shown up for Barca this season. I mean, quickly on that, before I'll let you go, Xavi announcing that he's going to stay at Barca after all.
Yeah.
He is still in contract until 2025. He announced he was going to leave at the end of the season, and all the noise kind of went away, very much like it did with Tuchel at Bayern. And then because Barcelona are actually kind of doing all right now, comparatively, and the all of the noise has died down, and probably because I imagine Barcelona also can't really afford to appoint like a Tuchel. It looks like he's staying. Well, he is staying. He's announced he's staying. I'm not entirely sure this is going to end well for everyone.
Yeah.
Xavi probably should have just... been like, actually, I'm going
to
go.
I don't know. I think he's as well to go again.
Yeah.
Because where else are you going to go?
True. This is a good point. Yeah.
Like I feel this is the biggest club he's going to get the chance to work for based on his record, you know, which is, I think Xavi's lucky to have another season to manage Barcelona, even though it's a nightmare club to manage, as he himself said. You know, this is a living hell. I can't do it anymore. That was why he said he wanted to leave. And now he's obviously said, well, you know, compared to just irrelevance, which is where I would be if I didn't do this job for another year.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, that prospect doesn't seem that enticing either. As a footballer, he was obviously incredible. He was, he was the best midfielder of his generation. He sort of redefined the game in some ways, you know, all that. Since he stopped playing, he wastes a lot of time out in Qatar making money. You know, it's like, do you want to be a coach or? There's nothing wrong with making money. I mean, it's great, but like, it's like, how long do you think your knowledge of the game is going to stay relevant for? And then he comes in and sort of is managing Barcelona straight away. Yeah, I mean, to win the league is actually a great achievement when you consider how bad they are compared to Real Madrid, realistically.
Mm.
Surprising they managed to do that, but I would put it down more to Real Madrid having an off season, you know, just not really being that bothered about the league at the end of the day. I mean, you saw the sort of rage of Xavi when Barcelona were getting knocked out by PSG in such like maddening circumstances, where as Gundogan said, we destroyed ourselves. And I think that maybe crystallized in his head. You know, Xavi obviously got sent off before kicking over that thing. And I think he probably realized, maybe he thought, and I'm sure they all thought of Barcelona when they saw that draw, oh, this is opened up, you know? And if we get to the final and it's Wembley, we're Barcelona, we're back at Wembley, you know, we could actually do this thing.
Who knows?
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, in a one-off game, we could actually do this. You know, I don't think anyone at the start of the season was thinking them seriously as Champions League winners. But by the time that draw happened, it's like, and then they beat Paris away, and then it's a case of, okay, we just need to put them away at home. And instead, a first half red card and everything falls apart. Like, I think Xavi at that point realized, oh, my coaching career is actually over now. You know,
I wonder if there's been a bit of behind the scenes as well about like just assurances, because some of the stuff, I don't know if you ever, Sid Lowe wrote an amazing piece kind of just detailing a lot of the, was it Sid Lowe? Oh, it might have been Dermot Corrigan, who wrote a thing about, you know, Deco overriding Champions League squad selections and Xavi being like, what the fuck? Why is this guy in the squad? Or why is this person not in the squad for a Champions League game? And it just all getting a little bit like, how much control did Xavi actually have? And I think the treatment of Xavi from a lot of people was a bit like, how dare you treat one of our greatest ever players this way? But then I think that if he'd been delivering so consistently on the pitch, and I think there have been good moments, there have also been some real like head scratching moments from a coaching point of view.
Yeah.
I think for me, it was a bit like, yeah, I get it. I get that he probably won't get a job of that profile again now. Anyway, it might need another move before he can even get a job that high profile. But I'm wondering whether it's kind of worth it. Like, he was really, you could see he was really done, right? So I'm a bit like, okay, I get it. And who knows, like, you know, this time next season or around this time next season, we might be looking at them who they might have won another title and they might have kind of, you know, brought a lot more young players through and kind of cleared out some of the underperforming elder players that they signed on like big contracts, which put them in a lot of the time in this mess anyway. And who knows?
I mean, is Cancelo going to be one of those guys?
This is the thing. Like, I mean, to get him on loan initially, they had to do one of their kind of, they've assured the league that this, you know, this, that and the other. But, you know, people like Marcus Alonso, all of these kind of big contracts, which I'm not entirely sure they needed, I don't think. The thing that I take away from this is that I'm really intrigued just to see what direction Barcelona go in next season now. Because Xavi with a squad, you know, trying to kind of do that quote unquote golden generation Mark II, because I do think a lot of these youngsters coming through are of the quality, or the first time that they've had like this many, I think, who could potentially make a run into that Barcelona side and be like stalwarts.
Hmm.
I think we've seen flashes, but people have dropped off. You know, and I know they've had a lot of injuries as well of those youngsters, but
yeah,
it makes me interested to see what happens next season in terms of the direction they go. I think if they try and make a load of massive signings again, I think that would just be a big mistake.
I always expected that that would be the direction that Barcelona would take under Xavi. So when Xavi became the manager, I thought, okay, what this means is they're just going to absolutely double down on the Catalan stuff and going to go with like La Masia and all this kind of thing. And actually, that's not what happened at all. Instead, it was Leivers, Lewandowski, you know, Marcos Alonso, you know, Rafinha. And it was kind of hot. Like, what is the idea? I kind of assumed that like it would be, let's sort of double down on our values. Let's double down on the more than a club aspects of what we are, you know, all that kind of thing, you know, that will sort of give people a reason to sort of tolerate this inconsistent young team. You know what I mean? At least there'll be, you know, that's kind of what I thought they'd do. But instead it was like, no, let's sell Barca Studios. We've got 200 million euros now, you know, and we'll buy Jules Koundé, you know, we'll go into a bidding war against Todd Boehly, you know? So I didn't really get it. Now, that's because I suppose I mean, my way of looking at football is still probably unduly influenced by like Alex Ferguson building his little fledglings team at Man United. You know what I mean? But like, that's obviously a completely different, it's like almost a sort of a Christian boys club or something, you know, it's that long ago, it's that kind of ethos of like, yeah, come on lads, you know, he sort of, we're all living in a big dorm together. Whereas what Barcelona were thinking was in terms of like global markets and, you know, all this sort of, just this sort of nonsense. But like, I think at the end of it, like you need to have a team. When they actually, when you look at what they've been doing this season, then they've got like loads of players who have played, I mean, loads of like under 21 year olds who have played 20, 25, 30 matches in the case of the youngest of all, Yamal. And like, obviously, they shouldn't really be doing this either, in the sense that they've already destroyed Pedri and they're doing the same to Gavi. Yeah. You know, but like, you know, so you do need to have a few kind of older players to sort of to hang this around, as indeed Ferguson did in the example that's imprinted on my memory. But like, it's clearly the way that they should go, because they can't afford to like gamble money on big signings. They're not in that financial league. Like I don't know why they can't accept this. I don't know why they don't recast what they evidently have been seeing as a weakness, i.e. having to rely on their own players, as a strength. Like, this is what's so special about us, and we're going to be back and we're building the next great thing. And, you know, It just seems like such an obvious thing for them to do that I'm surprised they haven't been doing it already. And if they do start doing it, well, okay, great. At the same time, the problem is you burn out your players. Like, it is insane that they have a 16-year-old has appeared in 31 matches. 31 matches in the league.
Was it like youngest? Him and Kabasi were like the two youngest players to start a Champions League quarterfinal, right? I think it's like, yeah. Wow.
So, I mean, they're kind of... It's like, no, not like that. You know, I mean, yes, young players, but, you know, come on.
Be play sensible. The kids, but not that much.
But look, I think it's the right direction for them to go. And I don't really see what, they can't compete with Real Madrid now for, you know, the best players in the world. They're not in that league. They can't pay like Mbappe, you know, $1.5 million a week or whatever Real Madrid are going to be paying him. So fine, do something different. Like, I mean, maybe your guy won't be quite as good as him, but you never know, you know, give it a few years and we'll see how things go. But I think fair play to Xavi, might as well stay. And I mean, what's the point of looking for a coach now? Everyone's looking for a coach.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, there aren't really that many. I mean, Xabi Alonso is like the one obvious, like,
he's not going to be like, he's also going to be like Barcelona manager. Was no, he? Exactly. So
he's going to Real Madrid. It's so clear.
Point, yeah. Yeah.
Another point, season at Leverkusen, and then Real Madrid win the Champions League, coach Mbappe, you know, coach Bellingham. Yeah. You know, why would he settle for less?
Ken, listen, man, I know you've been podcasting all day and recording, and I really appreciate you taking way longer than we originally said that we were going to do to come and chat to us. Well, chat to me on Stadio.
Not at all. That's great. It was a pleasure.
Hopefully we'll do it another time when Moose is around, and or, you know, next time you guys are in Berlin or whatever, and we'll go and find another park to sit in and have all those people walk past us being like, what the fuck are these?
Who are these guys doing?
Just sat there with a load of mics.
Yeah.
Cheers, Ken. Great to chat to you.
Good to talk to you. Good luck.
Big thanks to Ken for stepping in. And if you don't check Second Captains, go and search for Second Captains wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to share Righteous House on Friday and Sunday. Moose and I will be back on Monday. And don't forget to check the Stadio Outros playlist on Spotify. Speaking of which, we're playing out on Don't Let Your Love Fade Away by Gene Williams. All right, everyone. Much love. Have a lovely weekend. And Moose and I will be back with you on Monday.